The story of the prophet Nathan calling King David to account for having a man killed in order to cover up his own adulterous tracks is a story of remarkable courage, because people who expose the corrupt actions of the super powerful don't always live to tell the story. And King David had already just shown that he would not stop at murder to protect his own public image. However, on this occasion, Nathan survives and the king admits his guilt and repents. But there was every reason to fear that the outcome could have been a lot uglier. There are all sorts of interesting directions that a preacher could take with this story, but tonight I want to pick up this image of confronting the super powerful and try to link up several different ideas, sufficiently different that you may wonder what on earth I'm doing for a little while, to link up a few ideas and questions that I hope will prove helpful. The Federal Treasurer, Wayne Swan, made a speech last Wednesday, which made the headlines mostly because he said that one of the major social and political inspirations for his life and work had been the music of Bruce Springsteen, and hence it made the news. But in the course of the speech, he also made some very interesting comments about this issue of confronting the super powerful in our own day and age. He named three billionaire mining magnates, and there are no prizes for guessing which three they might have been. He named them as people who think they have the right to manipulate our democracy and our national conversation to protect their disproportionate share of the nation's economic success. He said that there was a concerning view emerging that such vested interests should somehow be immune from criticism. And that when he had criticised these three people before, he suggested, the idea was promulgated that I had transgressed some new unwritten law that limits the scope of our democratic debates in this country with this command, don't criticise the powerful. Don't argue for equality. Sometimes I think that our age is unusually celebrity obsessed, and we probably are, but previous ages have had their versions of the same thing. And one of the things that always seems to be part of it is this feeling that certain people are above criticism. You'll remember a few weeks ago hearing the story of the Israelite people insisting that they wanted a king, even though the prophet Samuel tried to warn them how selfish and exploitative kings always become, they still wanted one. And it seems that an agreement to allow the king to do pretty much whatever he liked, uncriticised, was virtually part of the social contract. We know he'll do all that. We don't care. We don't even want to hear about it. Just we want one. And you can see this same obsession coming through in the series of readings that we're hearing at present from John's Gospel. Last week we heard how the crowd who Jesus had just fed in the wilderness wanted to make him king by force. And this week, we can hear them clamouring for more signs of power. Give us a sign, give us a sign. If someone will impress us and dazzle us with displays of power, then we offer them immunity from questioning. And if King David had killed the prophet Nathan for challenging him, the strange thing is that probably much of the population would have endorsed his right to do that. How dare you question our hero, the king, his right to do whatever he likes and to have whatever he wants. He's our king and he can do no wrong. Now, I want to veer off at a slight tangent here and ask whether perhaps we have done the same thing to God and whether perhaps that has crippled our understanding of God and our relationship with God. If we have tended to swallow the idea that the most powerful people are off limits from questions and criticism, how much more so have we tended to see God that way? How often have you heard lines like, God is God and you're not, so you just have to accept it? Or, God is in control and God knows best and it's not our place to call him into question? Or even just, God said it, I believe it, and that settles it, nothing further to talk about. And how often have you seen people who do ask challenging questions of God warned and rebuked and told that they are falling into dangerous doubts and imperiling their souls? Yes, it seems that since God is the most powerful of all, God is the one who we most cannot allow ourselves to question or challenge. But what if we did? What if a prophet like Nathan, instead of questioning the integrity of the king, questioned the integrity of God? What if the prophet told his parable of some serious injustice and then turned to God and said, "You are the one who has acted thus"? What then? Would that prophet be as lucky as Nathan? Or would such an action be the unforgivable sin, the one-way ticket to the fires of hell? I want to put it to you that interrogating God and interrogating what we have been told and taught of God is actually essential to a healthy relationship with God. And so it is not only something that God allows, it is something that God encourages. A couple of weeks ago, in the city of Arequipa in southern Peru, I visited a fascinating and rather confronting museum. Mark and Acacia were with me. It's dedicated to a 14-year-old Inca girl named Juanita, whose frozen, mummified body was found at the top of the El Misti volcano, which overlooks the city. Juanita had been killed by her people 500 years ago as an offering to appease the mountain god at a time when the volcano was smoking and threatening to erupt. Juanita's frozen body is on display in the museum, and the whole museum explores the story of the Inca practice of human sacrifice. And part of the story is that Juanita would have lived her whole life knowing that that was her destiny. She was one of the chosen ones, set apart and honoured, worshipped even, as the unblemished innocent one whose sacrificial death would appease the angry god of the mountain and thereby save her people. And lots of people, as they walk through the museum, can be heard commenting on how disturbing it is that human beings could believe such things and act in such ways. But for me, what I found most disturbing was the realization that so many people still believe such things. And that, in fact, such beliefs are actually foundational to the ways that most of us evangelical Christians have understood and explained the meaning of the death of Jesus. But if we're not allowed to question God, or to question what we've been taught to believe of God, then we'd be stuck with that. And that's not good enough. So I want to follow in the steps of my namesake and call God to account here. God, is this true? Is it true that our sin leaves you so angry that you are like a raging volcano and that your wrath will not relent unless you are offered the sacrifice of a human life to pay the penalty and satisfy you? Is it true that only human blood can appease your anger? And that only the blood of an unblemished innocent one is pleasing enough to you to enable you to let go of that anger? Is it true that the tortured death of Jesus, the innocent Jesus, was pleasing to you? And that without it, you would have flung us all into hell? Because if that's true, God, then you are a monster. If that's true, you are a two-faced fraud. Because you tell us that we are to forgive freely and not demand any form of retribution when we have been wronged. But you are unwilling or unable to live up to that standard yourself. You want us to become more forgiving than you. We heard the call through your Apostle Paul tonight to lead a life worthy of the calling to which you have been called, with all humility and gentleness, with patience, bearing with one another in love. Well, what about you, God? Where's your humility and gentleness and patience and forbearing love if you get so angry and vengeful that you have to take it out on an innocent victim, making someone suffer horribly so that you can get it off your chest? Where's your integrity? Where is your much vaunted love and mercy and grace? Is it all a sham? Lightning hasn't struck yet. But how does God answer? If the accusation is made, what is God's defense? Will God offer a mea culpa like David did, guilty as charged? In some ways, yes. At one level, God is saying, yes, the charges that you have leveled are correct. The God that you have been worshipping is a two-faced monster who feigns love and mercy but demands retribution in innocent blood. The God that you have been describing is no different from the mountain god of the Incas. But that God is not me. Never was, never will be. And to prove it, God becomes human and comes among us in the person of Jesus to show us exactly who God is and what God is like. Jesus is God's defense. God's answer to our charges. As we heard the Apostle Paul say of Jesus in our second reading tonight, the one who descended is the same one who ascended far above the heavens that he might fill all things. The same one. The God who came down to earth is the same one who reigns in heaven and fills all things. We are not dealing with the nice side of God in Jesus, while the angry, vengeful side of God is thundering from the heavens. Everything that we have seen in Jesus is the whole truth about the whole God. The patient love and extravagant mercy and generous hospitality that we have encountered in Jesus is the whole story of God. Not just the nice side, the whole story. So, am I blithely dismissing centuries of descriptions of Jesus as a sacrificial victim who takes upon himself the punishment for the sins of the world? No, I'm not, actually. I still believe that Jesus gave his life as a sacrifice for the salvation of the world. But you see, there's one little presupposition that with almost no support at all from the New Testament has been smuggled into our thinking about the meaning of the sacrifice of Jesus, and it distorts the whole story into one of an angry, vengeful God. The dubious presupposition is that when we talk about Jesus being a sacrifice, it is to God that he is sacrificed, and it is God's anger that demands the sacrifice. And this is actually the great lie that has run through much of the history of Christian thinking and through the Inca religion and actually pretty much every other religion on the face of the earth. An essential part of what Jesus came to show us is that it is us who gets angry and demands blood and imagines that the sacrifice of an innocent victim will save us. It is us. But in order to justify it to ourselves, we project it onto God and imagine that our anger and our bloodshed are expressions of fierce loyalty to God. And so Jesus comes saying, no, no, no. Have you not heard? I want mercy, not sacrifice. But this radical new teaching of Jesus, this picture of a God who does not demand blood and demand the violent policing of every social boundary, but wants mercy and hospitality and reconciliation, this teaching so upsets the apple cart that the whole structure of society is threatened. If we can no longer use God to justify our strenuous protection of our borders, to keep our chosen selves privileged over those lesser outsiders, and if we can no longer use God to justify our blaming of the Jews or the homosexuals or the Aborigines or the liberal heretics for every social ill, and if we can no longer say our nation right or wrong, our king right or wrong, our culture right or wrong, then the whole structure of society as we know it begins to unravel and there'll be chaos. And so how dare he? He must be a blasphemer. He's a threat to national security and to religion and to law and order. And ultimately, it's better that one man die than that the wrath of God or the wrath of Rome come down on all of us. And sure enough, the next thing, you've got an angry mob chanting, crucify him, crucify him. And so the sacrificial system, which is our system, not God's, grinds on again and swallows up another victim as Jesus offers himself as the sacrifice to end all sacrifices. The sacrifice who is sacrificed to our anger and who unmasks the lie at the heart of the system. The lie that says our anger is God's anger and our demand for blood is the voice of God. And so Jesus takes upon himself the sin of the world, the anger of the world, the bitterness and rage and violence of the world, and absorbs it whole that it might do its worst and be exposed as a vacuous lie when Jesus comes back from the dead and he still has not been rendered angry or vengeful by the worst that we could do to him. He still comes to us with open arms, speaking only words of love and forgiveness and outrageous, unbelievable mercy. But we still find it so hard to accept what Jesus had to say. We are still so often like those crowds who followed him around, clamoring for signs of power and wanting to make him king so that they could invoke his name to destroy their enemies, presumably. But Jesus gives them no signs of power. Even under torture, he will not satisfy them by coming down from the cross and calling down legions of angels. He would not give them signs of power, only signs of humble service and gracious hospitality. But so often we still hunger to be dazzled by displays of power, and we're happy to give unquestioning allegiance to those who will provide it. And so we elevate others as our idols, our gods beyond question. And such gods go on demanding sacrifices, the sacrifices that we keep offering them to preserve them in the power and privilege that we love to ogle at. God welcomes and even longs for our questions, our challenges, our rebellion against the lies that we have so often been told about God. Because it is only with such courageous scrutiny that God can hope to emerge from under the layers of false images that we have projected onto him. So God's answer keeps quietly being offered as Jesus keeps coming to us with towel and basin in hand, graciously welcoming us, and more than willing to get on his knees and wash our aching feet. And he continues to call us to see in him the aching love of the only God who is worthy of the name, the God who will offer himself as a sacrifice to our anger, if that's what it takes to drain it away and open us up to the wondrous, unexpected revelation of God's limitless love and grace. Amen. Amen.